Kia ora, I'm Troy, Hero's Chief Executive, and welcome to Stirring the Pot. Thanks for connecting. If you're new, here's what you can expect. We're going to be talking the tough stuff, the things that keep us middle minds up at night. There are many challenges facing our industry, and equally many opinions on how we should tackle them. Stirring the Pot provides a facilitated forum to discuss and challenge these viewpoints.
The construction industry in Aotearoa is at a tipping point. Costs are rising, resources are tightening, and the pressure to build sustainably while still delivering on time and on budget is growing louder. We've heard it in MBE's forecasts, in industry sentiment, and even through HERA's own member surveys. Reusability and circular economy are no longer fringe ideas. They've become central to how we future-proof this sector. And that's where the digital steel passport comes in. It's a pilot project exploring how digital product passports can transform the way we design, build, and reuse materials.
Well, to unpack this, we spoke with Mick from Rosella Street, who's been at the front of developing digital product passport systems. Mick is a co-founder and director of Rosella Street, and he has a wide experience in digital product passports. Not only steel, they have different product passports for different products. Their platform offers a good solution, a preferable solution for us, because it provides the users with the flexibility to create projects. We asked Mick to start with the basics and what exactly is a digital product passport, since he was an expert in digital product passport.
So a digital product passport is a relatively new concept, and I think not everyone's heard of digital product passports. We started looking into digital product passports a couple of years ago when we were looking at innovations and initiatives in Europe. They're often at the forefront of circularity and sustainability, and we draw some inspiration from what they're doing in Europe. And in Europe, they were introducing a new regulation called the Eco-Design for Sustainable Products Regulation, which essentially supported somebody who was buying a product to be able to compare a file of digital information about two products to be able to inform their purchasing decision. And the file includes environmental impact information, so it enables somebody that's buying a product to be able to take environmental impact information into consideration. So a digital product passport is that digital file of information which includes technical specifications, environmental impact information, information about the materials that are included within a product, and also any certificates and accreditations that support any claims made where in the digital product passport file itself. It's a little bit different to a normal static record. So there's an element of dynamicism in a digital product passport. When somebody buys a product with a digital product passport, they take on an instance of the digital product passport, or DPP, I'll refer to it as, and that goes into their account. They then can add additional information to the digital product passport, including where the digital product passport is included within a project. They can also add information about events which might impact on their product throughout its life. So it might be that the product is exposed to certain events like an earthquake or a flood, mm-hmm. and they can add information about the product. And in the same vein, a manufacturer of a product can add a piece of information to the digital product passport, and it will flow up to the purchaser's or the buyer's record. So there's a difference between a digital file for a digital product passport versus just a normal digital file, which is a static file. So you asked the question about what's the difference between a digital product passport as a sort of instance and a project. Yeah. So digital product passports can be added to, I mentioned they can be added to an account. And in a user's account in our system, in the Rosella Street Digital Product Passport system, a account owner can add a number of projects that they might be working on. An account owner is usually like a project funder or their contractors, and they can add the particular project that they're working on. So when they procure products which have digital product passports, they can add those products and materials to their project. That way they can build up a bank of digital product passports for their particular project, a list of all the different products which have DPPs in their project. And what the system does is it automatically breaks down the information in the digital product passport and builds up a material bank. There's value that is obtained through the granular information collected in a digital product passport by being able to add it to your project, and then the information that's contained within being able to be broken down and feeding into reporting and so on.
I think that's what makes your platform unique, because maybe people, when they hear about the digital product passport, they will think that it's just like a QR code that I'll scan and then I'll read information, but there is much more than this to it. So that brings us to another point in the discussion. So how can this digital product passport and the bank that clients will construct be implemented in the current construction workflow without influencing or making significant changes to the process? How they can benefit from it, in other words, without making changes that will incur cost and will incur things that they may not be happy to do.
Yeah, so there's three key role types in the digital product passport system that we've built. So there's manufacturers, there's project owners, they're the entities that fund projects, and then you have the contractors that are working on a project on behalf of project funders. So just to start with the manufacturers, the manufacturers have an incentive to create a digital product passport because when a digital product passport is created, it automatically gets listed in an Australia New Zealand digital product passport database. And the digital product passport database can be filtered for based on a number of different parameters. So you can filter based on where the product's manufactured, for example, and that could be of interest to a buyer in terms of trying to procure or support local industry. You can filter based on a minimum percentage of recycled content, which can support procurement goals. You can filter based on end of life outcomes. So you might only be looking for products which are recyclable or reusable or compostable, depending on what the product might be. And you can also filter for products which don't have chemicals of concern or hazardous substances. So there's a real pull factor there from some of the big procurers that are really interested in some of this information. So for a manufacturer, being able to list your product in this database and expose to local, state and federal government across Australia and New Zealand, and also some of the big private procuring entities is a huge benefit to them. So there's the benefit there from the manufacturer side. From the buyer side, they're the ultimate beneficiary of a rich stream of information, which comes from DPPs.
Yeah.
So they fund the project, they are able to get the information on the material bank that's built up. So from the buyer side, the information on the types of materials and the volumes of those materials that are in their project enable them to be able to then generate future reports, so they can look at a future financial year based on material information that's captured in a DPP about how long the product is expected to be used.
And if you remember in our workshops, the people who were mostly asking questions and mostly interested were distributors, people who handle a lot of paperwork and who deal with buyers all the time. So probably, yes, that's where we will have a big value for the digital product passport or digital steel passport. But I think also at the end life, I think people also are not really concentrating on the fact that there is a huge benefit at the end life. If you are going to reuse steel from a project with the platform, you will have all the information you need to be able to reuse this steel. And that's a huge added value that will save time and can actually, it does not need any changes. It actually makes people life easier in terms of how they handle steel at the end of life.
Yeah, just on that, I think that's a really exciting part of the platform, actually, because at the moment there's a lot of information that those distributors or manufacturers need to pass on to the buyers, mm-hmm. and they can spend a lot of time having to support their buyers through detailed product information. But because it's a single high trust and a very comprehensive record, it's something mm-hmm. that they can provide to their buyers or people interested in buying their particular products, and without having to send lots of amount of sort of emails and information to different people and
paperwork.
Paperwork.
So the key thing here is that it doesn't add more admin work. It actually reduces it. And that's why we have such strong interest from distributors and project owners during our workshops. They are already drawing on in paperwork and compliance requests. So when they see that Passport can pull information together in one place and even automate reporting, it immediately clicks. This isn't about adding another layer. It's about making existing processes faster and easier.
I mean, if the system's going to work, though, it can't just be local. It has to line up with what's happening internationally while still working for New Zealand manufacturers.
Yeah.
So, well, talking about paperwork, like we know that this type of like platform, we have different certifications, different standards are implemented. A lot of information are brought in one platform. Does the digital product Passport itself follow a certain standard or a framework or a standard? Is there something that it follows, or it's up to us how to do it?
Yeah, so the digital product Passport is developed specifically for Australian and New Zealand, but also complies with international frameworks around digital product passports. So just to start mm-hmm. with the international alignment, it's really important because from 2027, products which are sold on the EU market will have to have digital product passports starting from 2027. So that includes products which are exported from New Zealand and Australia to the European Union. So we had to make sure that the digital product passport was interoperable with the emerging frameworks there. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the Australia and New Zealand context, we also need to make sure that the relevant frameworks that support construction and also facilitate reuse, that the system is and the product records are aligned to those across Australia and New Zealand. So we've designed the system in that way. When a record is being created by the manufacturer, making sure that the record itself complies with some of the key frameworks, including supporting evidence, which is required by certain frameworks when a particular claim is being made. So, for example, if it's a recycled content claim, the framework for recycled content traceability specifies types of evidence that are acceptable to support a recycled content claim. So we go through the system as a manufacturer goes through the system and enters information in. The system prompts for the relevant supporting evidence to be added to the record.
Now, we're talking a lot about data and information that are provided to the digital product passport. That will probably trigger a question in most people's mind: who owns this data and who maintains it? Like, that's, I think that's one of the very important questions for people to understand.
It certainly is. So the information in a digital product passport is owned by the manufacturer. And the manufacturer makes a decision about the amount of information that they add to a digital product passport, and they can add or delete information at any point in time.
Can other people add information to it later on later stages, like a fabricator, for example, who received this digital product passport from a manufacturer and then made fabrication that you know, introduced new things to the product? Can they add these details? Yeah, that's one of the questions we're looking forward to answer. Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So I think you've been multiple. I've heard you more than once saying that data has to be verified. So what are the mechanisms? Like, how does the system handle private versus manufactured issued data? I think There are two ways to input information, to input information for a digital product passport. There is the normal path followed by manufacturer, and there is the private path followed by a user. Can you explain the difference and tell us how can we trust, like how the data is verified, especially within the private digital product passport context?
So we have a couple of different options for creating digital product passports. The first one's from a manufacturer, but if you're working on a project, there is likely to be some gaps in the products that you are adding into your project. They won't all have digital product passports, particularly given that it's a new and emerging product that will be used by in the construction infrastructure and fit out world. So where you're adding a product or a material to a project and it doesn't have a digital product passport, the project team can create a version of a digital product passport called a private digital product passport. And a private digital product passport is something that, when created, can be reused by the particular organization or government agency that is funding the project. So once they create that, they can use it across several of their projects. And the way that a private digital product passport is created is pulling together all of the information that is available on the product. And it doesn't necessarily mean that because it's created by the project team, it's necessarily a low trust record, because a product which is created by the project team can also be created from the base of an environmental product declaration, for example, or a GECA label, or other types of labels. And they can be attached to the private digital product passport record. So you can actually have a really high trust and have high confidence in the claims which are made within a private digital product passport. And then, as mentioned, use it across your projects. And as you do, it contributes to building your material bank. The other thing that I wanted to mention around that is that there's a whole lot of reporting that gets automatically generated from digital product passports, including being able to extract a file of all of the products and materials which have been used in a project, and all of the supporting documentation, for example, third-party accreditations and testing and so on, can also be extracted, and that can support accreditation programs across New Zealand. And so there's a really useful file of information that's extracted to be able to support those particular processes. And we also collect climate and environmental impact information, carbon information, and that together is a really high value pack of information. And it gets back a little bit to one of your earlier questions around, is it additional work for each of the different entities that are using the digital product passport? And the return on investment in terms of reporting is one of the things that really saves people time and manages to offset some of the manual processes, which are quite cumbersome and not also as accurate as being able to have a record that's generated from a system. So there's some big benefits in that space.
Mick's insights kind of show us what the passports could mean here in Aotearoa, from reducing admin today to creating full material banks and transform how we reuse. But the New Zealand isn't working in isolation, because around the world, digital product passports are already moving from pilot ideas to policy requirements.
The digital product passport system developed to be usable at different by different authorities around the world. In 2027, it's going to be mandatory for products imported by the European Union to have digital product passports. That means everybody must comply with this, otherwise they won't be able to sell in the European Union. Another important thing is there are other countries that started showing some signs of willingness to adopt the system, like China, for example, where the recent development of another steel product passport. So it is very important that this system works well with other systems around the world. To understand how the rest of the world is approaching this shift, what lessons we can bring home, I spoke with Caroline from GS1, who's been closely involved in these international developments.
Thank you, Caroline, for being here. You
You've been a big supporter to this project since the start. I always remember that you gave us many material to read when I joined. I received a lot of papers from your side, examples from other places in the world, especially that example you shared with me from China. It was really interesting to see what the other guys are doing outside New Zealand. And that's why the first thing I would like to discuss with you is, how do we define a digital product passport in an international context and in an EU context? I know that GS1 is an international company. You've dealt with people in many places. So how do they define a digital product passport?
Wow. Thank you, Osama. Big question, so I'll try and break it down a little bit. So a digital product passport is more of, think of it like a tool. So it is a way of combining all the data about a product and enabling that to be shared, to be across borders or with your supply chain partners, or even right down to the consumer. The idea of it is about transparency, about circularity, it's about sustainability, and it's about keeping that information with the product and moving it through. When you think about international, okay, the Europeans are looking to legislate and use digital product passport as part of their legislation for certain products and sectors. The rest of the world perhaps also could look at this and go, wow, actually this is quite a good idea. Maybe they don't need to have legislation, but if they are going to trade with European countries, they need to be able to show those or meet those regulations in order to continue the trade. I think from a GS1 perspective, we looked at it and went, we have a way of enabling that data to be captured with a unique identifier and using a data carrier like a QR code to be able to share it and make it available. So we're not proposing that every single country in the world has to adopt this, but we think it is a really good idea. And to have a sustainable and circularity end game, really, for digital product passports, I think it is a good thing. Whether or not the whole world adopts it, I don't know.
Thank you very much. I agree with you. It's kind of, it needs self-awareness to apply such a concept. It's very important to realize that you're doing something for the future generations. It's really important to have that transparency you mentioned. But something also important that you mentioned is legalization. We know that probably what triggered the uptake of the digital product passport in Europe was the requirement to have a digital product passport for any imported good by 2027. Do you think there are other things that triggered their interest in this concept? Do you think any other type of regulations, Green Deal, anything else other than legalization that can probably make people want to adapt to the concept of digital product passport?
I think there are a number of different regulations that come into play here. For construction products, there's the CPR, Construction Products Regulations. Mm. Yes, you mentioned the Green Deal is one of them. There's also the Circular Economy Action Plan. And there are also some regulations around sustainability and also like the right to repair. And those have been passed by the EU, and I also believe some of them the UN as well. So a little bit wider than just EU.
I never heard of UN, but yeah, what kind of legalization they have in the UN? Can you just...
I think I'm not an expert on the UN. We have one of our consultants is our 2D lead, has actually just come back from the UN, and we were listening to a talk this morning, and she was talking about that this is being discussed at UN level, looking at digital product passports and digital twins, and how the world could look at, you know, how when we have things like tariffs, the world is looking, okay, well, where do I trade if I can't trade with that country anymore because it's not making economic sense for the businesses here? Maybe I have to look somewhere else. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. So, for like, do you think what triggers their interest is it commercially? Is it based on their commercial needs, or is it based on sustainability? Do you think they believe that this initiative is going to make them more efficient, or are they doing this because they think it's the good thing to do for a sustainable future?
I would like to hope that businesses are looking at sustainability not just from a perspective of their actual product, but from their whole business holistically, and what is good for the country and inevitably for the planet. I think some people are a little afraid of the word sustainability, and we see sort of a move away from all sustainability. It means more cost, it means I have to be more transparent. But the other side of that is the economic benefits, and I think it's been proved time and time again, there are economic benefits from adopting sustainable business practices. And if we look at it, and as I'm a older lady, I look at it from perspective of children and grandchildren, of what are we leaving them on the planet. And if we have embedded these sustainable ideas and practices, that these up-and-coming people will pick them up and continue it. And what kind of world would that be?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the concept is a combination of both efficient cost and sustainability. Yeah. So combining both together, actually you cannot separate cost from sustainability. Sustainability has three pillars: environmental, economical, and social.
Yep.
So if you only focus on the environmental part, you're not sustainable. And digital product passports are good because they actually address the economical part of the problem and the sustainable part of the problem. That's why I think this initiative is really going to be a game changer here. Talking about this initiative again, we do it here. We're in here, most of our focus is on steel, and what we're doing right now is a digital product passport for steel. But what other types of construction sectors are doing it right now in Europe? Do you have an idea of who might be doing it right now and what kind of things they are doing to apply the system?
So I believe that the EU, with organization called Surpass2, is also working on digital product passports for steel and for concrete and for wood products, because after batteries, construction products are the next sort of sector to be focused on. The regulations won't come through for a while yet, but I think they're looking at pilots to try and see how do we do this in the best way. Yes, different sectors have different regulations and requirements, but if they can make something a kind of template that could work across the industries, that could be almost interoperable but able to encapsulate information for concrete and for steel and for wood and for any other construction product or part, that I think that would be the way to go. But again, if you're thinking about individual industries, sometimes there is a mindset that, oh, well, but we are this and we need this information and we need this for us. And yeah, so I think it won't be an easy job to get everybody together and to get everyone to agree, probably why they've left a little bit of time before that actually becomes regulation.
I again have to agree with you on this, because you basically don't build a building out of steel only. The way our digital product passport platform works is it generates a project for the user that, and they can export and add digital product passports in their project, so they become visible to other users. So a project is not only defined by one component or one material, it has to be defined by everything that is involved in the construction. So I think, yeah, it should always, I've seen one example is the modular rebar system by GS1. It's based on GS1 model.
Yep.
That was really a good system. It combined steel with concrete in a very good way. I really liked this example. How data is normally structured and used in a digital product passport?
One idea that I have seen is around buildings having a digital logbook,
mm-hmm.
and that is where the different digital product passport templates are all housed together and kept into one entity. And using a GS1 standard is called a GLN, which is a location. So you could tie something, even using geographic locations, to a digital logbook. It means that in terms of in 50, 60, 100 years' time, if that building needed to be decommissioned, they could access the digital logbook and all the different templates for the concrete, the steel, the wood, the bits and pieces, the even the plant material, the machinery inside it, could be decommissioned or repurposed or reused. And to me, I look at that and think, if I, as a homeowner, if I had a digital logbook, that would save me a lot of time looking through files trying to find out, when do we need to replace our roof? When do we need to repaint the exterior of the house? Where did this thing come from? What colour is the carpet? If we had something that is a digital representation or a logbook of every building, I think of the possibilities that that could have. I think the early lessons are that there does need to be involvement with the manufacturers. There does need to be lots of stakeholders in the discussion. We need to understand who are the people who need the information, how does that information need to be transferred, what parts of it, and is there an ability to keep some things back. Yes, I think we need transparency, but also if you have a specific recipe for, and that is your IP or your patent, you don't want to be sharing that publicly. So I think there is some discussion around what could be kept private or locked or only accessible to certain people, but an agreement on what is freely and publicly available and able to be shared and interoperable. But again, having all the stakeholders and getting people to decide on that, I don't think would be, it's not an easy way to do it, and I think everybody would have an opinion.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
But I think enough talking about it and perhaps doing some trials and some pilots and looking at different options, I think people would see the benefit and companies would see the benefit.
Yeah, from our workshops, I noticed that when we used to have some of our workshops used to be dominant by certain type of stakeholders.
Yeah.
So they used to have their, you know, certain type of interests on certain aspects of the project. And when we used to go to other workshops, we used to meet new people who have other things to discuss, other concerns. So it seems that it's catching interest in different levels, and the trick and the challenge we have right now is how to make it appealing to all types of stakeholders. And that is why we're having this pilot study. That's why, by the way, we also have another round of workshops in September.
Great.
And mostly another one in November. So yeah, we are trying to collect as much information as we can for to be able to make it appealing to all types of stakeholders.